Welcome to Staging Business Behind the Scenes. I'm your host, Janet Davis. I'm also a trained musician, actor, and dancer. But most importantly for our conversation, I'm a seasoned expert in nonprofit administration, with a specialty in working with leadership teams and boards at arts and cultural organizations. My mission is to make sure that the artists of our time have everything they need to make our hearts beat faster, bring us peace, help us find something in common with someone else, thrill us with athleticism and talent, or tell a story that needs to be told in a way that all of us can understand. I've learned over the years that the tricky business of creativity is often underplanned, underdeveloped, and underled. And if we don't do anything about it, the theaters, orchestras, museums, art halls, and dance companies that are telling the stories of our communities will not survive. This show is not about advocating for the arts or sharing the remarkable lives of great artists or reviewing shows or exhibitions. We're here to help the administrators, the leaders behind the scenes, the managing directors, financial directors, development directors, facilities teams, and marketers. We will pull back the curtain on a topic important to our listeners. Whether you are a member of the leadership team, a board member, or a staff member, our objective is to help you have your best ideas yet as we shine a spotlight on various challenges and opportunities of arts management. Strategy, operational planning, earned and contributed income, technology, and facilities, to name a few. I'm Janet Davis, and this is Staging Business Behind the Scenes. Join me as we master the business of creativity.
Good morning. Here I am at the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire with Jerrianne Bogus, the executive director, who is a wonderful friend in our community and has been here a long time in New Hampshire and has made transformational work of helping us all understand a more deep history of our state than I think many people even would imagine. So thank you for your work and thank you for being here.
And thank you so much for having me, Janet. It's a pleasure.
So let's start out and just tell us a little bit about where we are in the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. And what is your vision for going forward and for the institution?
So thank you for coming to our headquarters here in Portsmouth. We're located, the Black Heritage Trail is located in downtown Portsmouth in our historic district. And, you know, most of the time we tell the story of Portsmouth, the white story, but what we're doing is telling that long, for over 400 year history of Black history here in Portsmouth and New Hampshire. We are a stone's throw away from the African burying ground, which was built over, covered, erased from our public memory, and recently restored in 2015 to a memorial site that really tells is a visible telling of New Hampshire's connection to the slave trade and our history of having Black people being here for over 400 years. And incidentally, Black folks had been here before European contact. So we like to tell a full, complete story of our state. And I think that's the impact we have, is really changing what people think about the state. You know, New Hampshire's been thought of or referred to as one of the whitest state in the Union, thus erasing that history, that rich, more colorful, more inclusive history. And that's what it is we're doing. We believe that by raising awareness for these stories, this history, this unvarnished history, the truth telling, that we can better understand how we got to where we are in our state, in our country, our stereotypical ideas of who we think Black people are, by looking at more some of these, our forebearers, Africans, African Americans in the state, how they persevered, the things they did, their story of courage, their stories of success, their stories of integration, just really changes who and what we think Black folks are. And understanding that gives us a better understanding for our present and helps us to create a much more just society for the future.
You are not only an executive director, you're an author, and you are a curator of the work here. You are a connector in the community. How's it going? Have you had any surprises as executive director? And what do you see going forward are going to be your biggest opportunities?
So, surprise stuff. I think what was surprising before I even started this work, that there was Black history in New Hampshire, that there was so much of it, you know, in every little corner, every little town, there was just this kind of pearl, this onion that you peel back and it just keeps growing, you know, and creating that rich texture of a state that I think if left out, you just don't get that variety. You don't get those stories. So I was really surprised at the depth and breadth of this history here. And, you know, that when we start looking, everything was written down. And I also was surprised at the mobility of people back then, because you think, you know, we didn't have cars and all that stuff, but they got around. People were moving from here, you know, all the way up to Colebrook, New Hampshire, you know, and then out of the state everywhere else. So that movement, you know, whether it was to find jobs or create families, connect to lost families, that movement was really surprising. And I looked at, you know, the history as being sedentary, but it was not at all. I think in just getting these stories out, I think is just, you know, when people come and say, oh, we did not know that. We didn't know that Ona Judge, who was formerly enslaved to George and Martha Washington, came to Portsmouth. And they didn't know her story of courage and, you know, the will to be free. You know, then that blows their mind. And that's really fun to bring these stories to light, because it not only changes the perception of, like I said earlier, of that one individual, but it changes the perception of our state, changes the perception of Black people on a whole. You know, I think when I look back and someone had sent that Black history in the state really represents that our state motto of live free or die, you know, and it's like, wow, isn't that the truth? Because what they did for freedom, you know.
Yeah. When I first moved here, I've been coming here my whole life, and my father was raised here. And when I moved here permanently, I looked around, and I came from Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. I looked around and I said, where is everybody? Where is everybody? Meaning people of color.
Yeah.
It surprised me, mm-hmm. because even though I'd been coming here and I travel quite a bit, I expected there to be more diversity because it's New England.
Yeah.
Right? You sort of think, okay, this is where, you know, this is where diversity is celebrated.
Yeah.
But I'm learning that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
Right? So tell me a little bit about the fact that you're growing. You know, you look at where you were when you took over in 2017 and where you've come since then. My impression is that this is an organization that has not only bloomed from its roots in terms of the content that you manage and that you present, but also in your ability to function and to serve. So tell me a little bit about how's it going in terms of the growth, and what do you attribute that to? Is it people are interested in the topic, or what's your perspective on that?
I would think we were growing before the George Floyd murder. We were doing a steady growth. But I think during that traumatic time for the country, the awareness that America had a race problem came to light. And people really wanted to know. I don't think it's the first time that majority of people wanted to know what was happening. We saw that in the 60s during the Civil Rights Movement. So this was another kind of reawakening. Oh yeah, we do have a problem. And so that really pushed us forward. I think we had a reputation of having conversations that you don't normally have about race and diversity and inclusion. We were having those community dialogues before. So we just provided that space to go deeper into that conversation. We were a place that people who were seeking to understand how we got to where we were, because most of our events, most of our programs have a connection to our history, whether it be our local history here in New Hampshire or national history. Grounded in history, we look at contemporary issues and try to find ways of how to look at them differently for the future to create more just and equal society. So I think that George Floyd murder propelled us even further and realized that, you know, there we all had something to learn from it. And I think the other event in our state that brought us kind to the forefront was the passing of the divisive concept bill, you know, for educators, where we saw that as a way to suppress this Black history that from schools, if we have another generation growing up not knowing the truth about enslavement or the Civil Rights Movement or, you know, that any of our Black African American history, then it's another way of suppressing it. So, you know, some of the teachers around were looking to us to see what we, as a private institution, nonprofit institution, could do, what the public institutions could not do because of the law.
That's a remarkable way of framing the difference between private sector, public sector, and I'll say community,
yeah,
and the way those things interact. I think we're hearing that now when we have, I was listening this morning to NHPR, and there was a story about the Orthodox Russian Church. And there are leaders in the Orthodox Church in Moscow who are not willing to condemn the war in Ukraine because they feel like they don't want to get political. Yeah. And by doing that, they are absolutely getting political, right? And so how, you know, it's interesting to me, and I think it is hopeful that our arts and cultural organizations can lead in this space. And I personally believe it's because we are good listeners and we know how to tell stories, and we know how to understand when a story should be told, and the importance of it.
I think also using the arts to tell these problematic stories, I think nonprofit institutions or organizations like us, although we can't lobby for legal changes to laws and stuff, because that's out of our purview, but we can speak from the historical points about issues that other people lobby about, if that makes sense. But I am thinking that we try to stay apolitical because that's our charter as a nonprofit, but everything you do is political. When we're talking about history, how can it not have a political bent when we're talking about social justice and equality? You know, some people, so we present the facts and then people on either side can look at the arguments. And I think the arts is one of those non-threatening ways that you can get the story out, whether it's through a play or music or the visual arts or anything. You have that creative way of entering to a story, entering into an issue without the baggage of political parties holding you to it. So that's why I love the form of the arts.
Are you a music fan?
I love music. I love visual arts, well, mostly.
Are you a Beyoncé fan?
Oh my God, the controversy now has just blown my mind.
Have you heard the album?
I haven't heard the whole album, but I've been reading the reviews. I saw I listened to the first song that came out, and that's a perfect example of our misunderstanding of history, of not knowing the origins of things, and believing and putting a political label on something that has no political label.
Yes.
Music.
Yes.
What I read and what I loved about what Beyoncé did is she took an incident, what I read, you know, of being at the Country Music Award and not feeling welcome and not feeling like she belonged, especially when country music was originated in the Black community, that she did that. She did her homework, right? She went and she researched and she did her homework, and then she did her own creative way of getting that story told. So it is a protest, right? It is a protest piece, and it is a re-examining of what we think whiteness is and what Blackness should be, right? And totally, a group on one political side is saying that then this thing belongs to us and they're taking it. No, it's quite the opposite. And she did that. She told it.
She did. So when you think about your colleagues here in New England and also nationally, what are some of the topics that when you go to conferences or you call your colleagues to say, hey, we're dealing with this, or what do you think about this? What are some of the topics that are concerning to you or exciting to you and hopeful?
So I'm actually going to be going to the first viewing of a new museum exhibit at Mystic Seaport that I just actually can't wait to go see, because they reimagined telling the American story from the beginning, from the Native American perspective before European contact, and from the African perspective before enslavement. So starting the story actually at its origin, you know, and so in doing this exhibit, they've changed the language from a colonized language to a more inclusive language. I can't wait to see what they've done with that. I was part of the advisory group that met, and we get to get a sneak preview. But just, I'm thinking of the use of language that totally blew my mind. The professor who's in charge of this, Debaris Gomez, we were talking, and there's just this one word she used as an example, and it totally blew my mind and totally changed the concept of what a museum could be. So she said they changed the word from, they're not dealing with artifacts, they're dealing with belongings. And just that change alone humanizes that story, humanizes what you're looking at, and creates a whole different thing in your brain when you look at a piece of somebody's belonging, you know? So that's one thing I'm excited about. How we tell the stories, how we tell our stories. How do we change from that, the prominent narrative of whiteness to a more inclusive story? How do we tell our Native American stories? How do we tell our African American stories? How do we tell our Asian stories? You know, America is richer because we are diverse, but we have always spoken with one voice, the white voice.
The concept of vocabulary, right? I find that it is right now extremely important, because even in the administrative side of arts and culture organizations, the vocabulary of how we do business is so different.
Yeah.
I think all of us are going to have to learn to broaden the vocabulary.
Oh yeah.
To your point, right? Yeah. I think the notion of belongings versus artifacts is a perfect example.
Yeah. I just look at that, and then, you know, there's the term that they're using now, which may be problematic, but still trying. That's the thing with language, right? It's a living thing, and it changes. but decolonizing our language. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean?
I think it means exactly what it says it means.
Right. No, but what is that effect on us once we decolonize that language?
Right.
That's what I mean to look at, to really reimagine this living thing, this language that we use, you know, how it includes or excludes a whole group of people. Mm-hmm. And if we start changing, not if, when we start changing this language, how powerfully that one tool can become, right? We see that in poets, right? In poetry, in slam poets, you know, with the judicious use of language, you know, can totally change a whole concept of being, right?
Yes.
So if we have this on this big scale of reimagining, it's in our museums, I just can't imagine what kind of more just world we can have.
What is your perception of the term museum?
Well, that's a tough one, because it's something I wrestle with all the time, in that we have, because I absolutely love museums. And I also have this love-hate relationship with them. How did they get this? You know, who's at the power? Who's the helm of, you know, this place that has these treasured belonging that may belong to somebody else? And then the selfish side of me is, but I would never get to see them. I really want to know. I want to know what that culture did. I want to know where I'm from. I want to know the depths of somebody else's culture and being. And I get that in a museum. And the arts, just the looking at arts, you just, you know, it takes you, it's transformative. It moves you someplace else. But when you think about the business of art, where they came from, you have to pause for a moment. Last year, I went to Tanzania, and I went to the site. I had to look up the word. Olduvai Gorge, and it's called the Cradle of Mankind. It was where the first skeleton remains of Homo sapiens were found. And it was profoundly impactful for me to see that, because I understood by going to that place in the centuries that of history behind that, you know, the first man to walk upright in this Tanzanian landscape, right, was found there. And I could understand the people, how they walked, you know, having this in your DNA, you've got to walk upright, you've got to be proud. You know, this is what I've carried generations through. And then I looked at that and I said, how did it get twisted that then that group, black people, were think of less than and inferior? And I looked and I said, the difference between being at that location to see where the site, that archaeological site, than being in a museum was profoundly different. You know, you could feel the energy of the place. But everybody won't have that experience of being able to go there, right? And see that and feel that. So how do we transform that kind of message into a place that the public can see, the general, that our kids, our, you know, younger people can grow up with this knowledge that can then transform how they see themselves in an environment? That's the thing, that's the place I look for where museums should be, and not this private collection of a rich donor who wants to show that I could afford this, or I could do this, or you get dressed up in your gown to go to an opening, or, you know, that kind of class distinctions. I think that that's the role museums should play. And this is another personal story why this representation is important. I have a granddaughter, 5 years old, and they were going to my son, a father-daughter event at their, not even kindergarten, preschool. And my granddaughter didn't want to get out of the car because she didn't feel like a girl. She didn't feel like a girl because of her curly hair and her dark skin. And it was like, at 5 years old, she's getting that message that she is not beautiful, not a girl, whatever that message is. She got that really clear at 5-year-old. So I think the museums with those ancientness that carries us back to, you know, ancient Egypt, Nubian queens, you know, stuff like that. And you see that connection to where you are can only empower. And that's where you become the art, like your artist said, you know. So I think those are the roles I would love museums to play.
All of the unconscious bias that we have, I believe, as you do, I think, that the arts can help us remove some of that. And we can, if we can understand someone's story.
Absolutely.
And have a conversation about how did it feel when you were in Africa? Like, why? Like, oh, I explain that to me. Yeah. That's a totally different kind of conversation than, oh, how fortunate and privileged we are to be able to go to Africa. Right? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's a totally different thing.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about when you are working with leaders, and if you have had other leaders in your life and in your experience who've made an impact, tell me about someone that you look back and you say, boy, that person, I call that person up all the time.
There are two leaders, women leaders, that I look to a lot that have really influenced me. I came to this work without a background in, without a historical background, without running an organization background, without even knowing how to write a grant in my early beginning. And Wanda Mitchell, she was the chief diversity officer at UNH when I worked there. And that woman was well put together, not only in her thinking, but in the documents that she sent out. She was very clear on policies, procedures, you know, highlighting stuff, getting it writing, something I'm still not good at, but I still try to be there, you know. But I learned that from her, to be really precise in your thinking, to be precise in your writing, to get it down and think long term. That's, you know, she was just always thinking of ways to do things better. You know, so I learned that from her. And the other person, the next big dreamer that I really admire and I currently still admire, is Yvonne Goldsberg from the Endowment for Health right here in New Hampshire in Concord. Little thing packing all this power behind her. Just the way she thinks, the role that she plays, public figure in a predominantly white, male-dominated environment, yet being able to hold her own, have the knowledge behind her to back up, and this just the smooth and easy way that she enters the conversation. She enters the conversation as if she has the right to be there, which she does. And she just does it calmly, no fan shows, no drum rolls, just that power of that calm knowledge that I belong right here, right now, at this time, doing what I'm doing.
Let's talk about this organization. And what do you and your team face that may make it important to have a healthy and a nurturing work environment here? And as a leader, how do you try to listen to your folks and your team and help that come to fruition?
So one of the things I do before every meeting, we have a staff meeting every week, is we've got the good news. So we start off just kind of building rapport, sharing your day. It's important to understand each of us from that personal level, and just for people to be themselves at work. I think, you know, the more transparent we are, the more honest we are, the more vulnerable we are, the healthier environment we have. So we try to, you know, be positive and share that. But, you know, if somebody's having a bad time, we also try to be comforting. But I think one of the most important thing is to have fun. Have fun with your staff. And we do kind of, you know, little things every once in a while. We just had a dinner with our staff. One member was leaving and we wrote a poem from him of, you know, and we did it together in a group, you know, so it was just a lot of laugh or, you know, just come up with these icebreakers that are kind of ridiculous and out there and just ways to, I think the word I will use is the ways to be vulnerable, because I've got my thing. I'm terrible at pronouncing some words, and they will laugh, okay, that's Jerry's doing that, that's her, you know, or somebody else has something, and, you know, somebody talks too long, we have a cock and stick, we'll pass it around, you know. Just creative ways of how to deal with our strengths and our weaknesses.
How to be imperfect.
How to be totally human and imperfect.
Tell me about Juneteenth. You've been working on this for probably almost a year, I can imagine.
So, you know, the Portsmouth has been, our Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail and other Black organizations in the town have been celebrating Juneteenth before it was a national holiday. And so they've always brought to light this moment of Black emancipation to the world and to look at it. I think for me, looking at Juneteenth it's empowering for African Americans, because it's when they took their own freedom into their hands and how to make it. And the celebration that is totally African American, this cultural view of our own power and freedom. So this year we decided to look at Black masculinity. And, you know, this is one of the things like you always, oh, let's not do anything that's stereotypical because, you know, this is what, you know, we're feminists, you know, why are we focusing on male or, you know, Black man? We know the stereotypes around what it means to be Black. So that's what we decided to look at. What would happen if we looked at the softer image of Black masculinity? And that's our question. As we celebrate Black fatherhood, brotherhood, sons, you know, what it means in a whole different perspective. And I hope that's what comes out, that we start looking at people for the multidimensionality that they carry. You know, I'm not just this or what you think I am. You know, I have this side. You know, we're not afraid to do that for other populations. But when it comes to Black masculinity, that stereotypical notion of somebody to be feared, you know, comes readily. And I hope that, you know, looking at the stories, the lived experience of the men that we're going to bring forward, looking at the art, you know, that we can start to reimagine it. What Blackness is. And that's what I want people to take away. I just, you know, in the work that we do, I want to push boundaries, push our minds open just a little bit. You never know what's going to enter somebody's mind and at what point it goes in to their soul to create that change, you know, because this work is changing people's deeply held beliefs. The way they've been socialized in an environment to believe something about somebody else, you know, by putting this whole net around them, right? Putting this box, putting them in a box. This is who you are. And what. So if we keep pushing that boundaries a little bit, and that little bit of light can come in, you know, I always imagine that little pinhole of light comes in, lightens up the whole room, the whole box, right? And that's what I'm hopeful for, that when people listen, the more personal stories get out, the more you connect, right? And the more we connect, the more we're changing our perception. The more we change our perception, the more we can be empathetic. the more we can walk in somebody else's shoes. And then that journey then takes us along that towards equity and justice and believing, because you're walking with somebody.
It's proximity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How can we help?
It's very trite to say, give us money.
It's not trite. That's real.
That's that reality.
Spoken like a good executive director.
but that's the reality of a nonprofit. We rely a lot on individual donations to keep the work going, grants, ideas, volunteers. Our volunteers are our next biggest treasures because, as you know, nonprofits are small, usually small staffed, with big ambitions, big goals, and we have to have bodies to help carry that out. So, you know, people, money. That's what. And, you know, it's great too for sharing ideas, you know, come in, share ideas, what you think you help, or, you know, just visit us to the openness to learn, you know, to want to know more. I think that's the start for any journey into something new, is to be open to it.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful that you're in our community and you're in our community and a neighbor and a friend and a leader.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
You bet.